Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
As I'm sure you're all very aware at this stage, we're in the midst of days of unrest across American cities since the death of George Floyd on May 25th in Minneapolis. Derek Chauvin, he's the police officer who had his knee on Floyd's neck, has been fired from his job and charged with third-degree murder, which is in effect manslaughter. The other three police officers at the scene have been fired but not charged with any criminal offence. They remain under investigation. Two different autopsies have concluded that George Floyd died from asphyxiation. In the midst of all the unrest, Donald Trump naturally has been causing headlines. He has most recently said the military will go in to restore order. He has tweeted when the looting starts, the shooting starts. He has talked about Second Amendment rights in the Rose Garden as opposed to First Amendment rights. And last night, there's a leaked phone call, which we'll play you now. He was talking to various state governors and made it very clear what he wants to see.
What happened in the state of Minnesota, they were electric stuff all over the world. And then they wiped out, you probably have to build a new one, but I've never seen anything like it. And the whole world was laughing. And I said, you got to use the National Guard to take numbers. They did it first, and they did. And I'll tell you, that, I don't know what it was. It was, Governor, it was the third night. Those guys walked through that stuff like it was butter. And you haven't had any problems since. I mean, they don't. They're not going to go there. Now they'll go to some other place. But once you called out and you dominated, you took the worst place and you made it. They didn't even cover it last night because there was so little action. Because you dominated. You dominated. Now, what happened to New York, I have to tell you, I live in Manhattan. What's going on in Manhattan? I have no idea. New York's finest. They need to do their job. I don't know what's happening in Manhattan, but it's terrible. But New York has got to have to toughen up. And we'll send you National Guard if you want. You have the largest police force in the country, 40,000 people, I understand. No domination, you have to dominate.
Delighted to say we have with us Dr. Harry Edwards, who's been on the show before. 1960s, he was writing his college dissertation on the sociology of sport. He was a founding architect of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, which ultimately led to the 1968 Black Power Salute. More recently, he has worked with the 49ers, the Golden State Warriors, as a consultant. Colin Kaepernick counts him very much as a mentor. He's written numerous books, including The Revolt of the Black Athlete. He is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Berkeley, and we're very glad he's made some time for us. Dr. Harry Edwards, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You've been around a very long time, and you've seen so much happen over the last however many decades. Can you, because it is hard to know how seismic events are sometimes in the midst of them, can you put some kind of historical context on what we're seeing across the cities of America, Harry?
Well, this is part of a long history of activism where people have been protesting the institutionalized circumstances of people of color in this country. The Constitution and so forth simply have not been applied with equal force and veracity to the circumstances of all of the people, and for African Americans, that means going back to slavery, right on through the choking to death of George Floyd. So this is part of a long history of protest, of social activism, and this is something too people have to realize. This is as much a part of the American political DNA as the flag, the American flag. I mean, Sam Adams and his Sons of Liberty movement were not a that was not a government program when they threw the 346 boxes of tea into the Boston Harbor. The same with regard to the abolitionist movement, the labor movement, the women's suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the black power movement, the gay rights movement. It has always been we the people who've taken the first step and then officials and government have hustled to keep up. The problem that we have now is that we have a morally malignant degenerate and a certifiable moron who advises people to drink bleach and inject disinfectant to deal with the coronavirus sitting up in the Oval Office. That's a major obstacle to the goals of the movement being achieved. But that also means that we only have, that's just another hurdle that we have to jump over in order to get this thing back on track.
Harry, when was the last time you saw something on this scale?
I would have to go back to the period right after Dr. King was assassinated. I don't think that the Rodney King situation in 1992 reached this level of national consciousness and commitment, involvement. I think that even then, in 1968, we did not have the social media, we did not have the infiltration of the movement to the extent that we have today. We know that there are foreign interests who are sending out information that antagonizes and disrupts the situation. Everybody who is among the demonstrators are not with the demonstrators. Everybody standing next to those who are sincerely concerned with this problem are not with them in terms of dealing with this problem. So we have all of those issues today that are different. So this makes this something that is really, really different. We have to understand that, not the least of which, of course, is that it's occurring in the midst of a pandemic which has taken over 106,000 lives in this country and made almost 2 million people sick.
Okay, because I was going to ask, why do you think this has captured the mood right across America this time? Because the incidents like the George Floyd death have happened far too often over, even the intervening decades since the LA riots of 92. So you've given a few reasons just there as to why you think it's caught the mood.
Well, there's also this. This was a lynching caught on television at prime time with a man literally begging for his life as he was asphyxiated to death by a white cop with his knee on this man's neck. That was dramatic. It was profoundly disturbing. And it occurs against a background where people have a lot of built-up anxiety, where they have a lot of built-up tension as a consequence of the pandemic, and the incompetent, criminal way that the president and his administration has handled this problem, from outright denial to, in point of fact, exacerbating the situation by refusing to take action that could have been taken to slow it down. And so all of that anxiety is there. And then the American people are sitting there in their homes, literally consigned to their homes, asked to stay home and stay safe. And this is what comes over the airwaves, over the cable networks, into their homes. And even though it was just one man, it's part of a long history and pattern of police action against the black community. 147 black men, women, and children killed every year since 1968 by the police, most of those men, women, and children unarmed. And this is as opposed to 40 black men, women, and children being lynched a year from 1882 to 1968. So we're now, under cover of the badge, murdering more black men, women, and children in this country than were lynched each year going back to 1882. All of that is coming to the fore. It's not just George Floyd. It's the circumstances, the backdrop of the pandemic, and what that has done in terms of anxiety. It's this uncouth, pathological liar and certifiable ignoramus that's sitting up in the Oval Office faking it as the president that people are so concerned about. No leadership, no direction, no policies, no programs that have anything to do with the people. And so now you have all of this flooding out of the American population, and it's going to go on for a while. We're one police killing caught on tape away from this thing really blowing up and exploding, even with the confluence of a second wave surge of the pandemic that's expected in late August, early September, if not before, due to what happened on Labor Day and what will likely happen on the 4th of July. We are entering hurricane season in late August and through in the end of October. So you have 50 million people who are going to be subjected to that anxiety, those problems along the Texas Gulf Coast and the East Coast. So all of this stuff is flooding forward under the worst federal leadership we have had in modern times and probably in any time going back to the days before Abraham Lincoln.
Harry, just to ask a specific question on police brutality, because as you said, it's been going on a long time, and there are many aspects to race relations in the US, and as you've said, it's part of the very fabric and DNA of the country. But the Black Lives Movement, for instance, sprang up in the midst of an African-American in the White House. And there seemed to me from afar, and this is the question, to be so many instant solutions that could help this situation. Ending the chokehold, for instance, banning it, use of force regulations could be changed, more accountability, and so on. You know, any number of very sensible, specific things which could take on police brutality amidst a bigger picture. Why hasn't that happened?
Well, because what we see, people forget that municipal police forces in the United States came into being under the auspices of the Fugitive Slave Act, really. That's where they really began to get their power and so forth. They were the northern force that helped to capture runaway slaves and in many instances to enslave black people who were free. It's like the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment, giving private citizens the right to own guns, came in consequence after the Revolutionary War, and the American civilian population had to have a means of controlling slave revolts and fending off Aboriginal natives who were fighting to keep their lands from being overrun by European and American interests, and to defend the lives of their own children and families and tribes and so forth. So the Second Amendment was voted in. These same forces still persist in American society. The police are here to protect white society from black people, and even when you see something on tape, we've had over the years those whites who've said, yeah, but we don't know what happened before the tape started, and we don't know what happened after. All we know is that a man was running away and was shot in the back 8 times, or that a young man was shot 21 times. This is something that's endemic to the structure of human and institutional relationships in American society. It has deep roots. The pain is in the communities of people of color. The problem is in communities, in white communities, and they've been extremely reluctant to get rid of the problem because it's so deeply connected to their sense of white supremacy, to their security and their privileges, and so forth. So until you begin to get people in the white community talking about how we're going to deal with the problem, the pain in the communities of people of color is likely to persist. I'm impressed by the diversity of the people out there marching and protesting. Young white kids, Latinos, Asians, African Americans, I'm impressed by all of that. But then the issue is, what is the follow-through? What are you going to do? Not in my community, but in your community where the problem is. And that has been a question that the white community has been reluctant to even recognize, much less address.
Harry, in a sporting context, this conversation has been having instigated in many ways by Colin Kaepernick for some time now. A quote of his from 2017, for instance, "I'm not protesting the anthem or the nation, I'm protesting organized brutality. to me, this is much bigger than football. It would be selfish to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder. If he was to say that in a month's time, let alone years ago, it couldn't be more prescient and of the moment. I saw a quote from you as well where you said, when Colin took a knee for the first time in the pre-season of 2016, I went into the locker room, I got his shoes, I got his jersey, his gloves, I had him autograph everything, and I sent them back to the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, and I told them to put them in a case right next to Muhammad Ali's gear. I knew at that time where this was going to go. So what Colin Kaepernick tried to start here and did start, talk to us about your reaction first off when you saw the NFL statement a few days ago and Roger Goodell.
Well, first of all, I mean, I read Roger's statement. I know Roger. We talk two or three times a month, and I know his heart. I know his fundamental sentiments, but he also works at the suffrage of the owners, who most of whom are very, very conservative, if not outright reactionary, and many of them are Trump supporters. And so when I read his statement, especially with the fact that Colin Kaepernick is still out there, Colin Kaepernick hangs over the NFL like a shroud. When I read Roger's statement, I mean, it could not have any less credulity. It could not have any less veracity if it had been Dracula pledging to make a donation to the blood bank. I mean, him talking about the NFL is going to stand up for justice, we're going to do our part and be responsible citizens and all the rest of that, as long as Colin Kaepernick is on the outside looking in, that kind of statement is laughable. And I'm quite certain that Roger realizes it, but as the commissioner, he had to make a statement. And it had to be a statement that essentially tried to put the NFL in a good light. It failed. It flopped. It was horrible. The other point is that it's part and parcel of the fact that they try to say that Colin Kaepernick is out of the league because he was an economic liability. There's nothing in the facts that validates that perspective. Nike made him their face of marketing in 2018, and their shoe sales and so forth increased by 32%. He had the most popular jersey in the country in 2016 and 2017. Most popular jersey in the NFL, even bigger than Tom Brady's. He has been one of the most popular figures in this country. So this notion that he's an economic liability is nonsense. It makes about as much sense as saying that we only have two African-American and one black Latino coach in the NFL today out of 32 teams, because black head coaches, and in point of fact, black GMs, there are only two of them, are an economic liability. We don't have representative numbers of black head coaches and GMs because of an entrenched, reactionary, and in many instances outright racist disposition on the parts of NFL owners. At a minimum, they are blindly arrogant to the times that they live in and the realities that are reflected when you have three black coaches out of 32 with locker rooms that are 75% black. Mm.
Trump famously in Alabama at a rally advised the NFL owners to get that son of a bitch off the field now. He's fired. Get him off. Mike Pence walked out of a game, and NFL owners and Goodell were in favor of a new policy where rather than taking the knee, you have to stay in the locker room. That was the NFL reaction. I know you talked to Colin Kaepernick. Is he bitter? Is he angry? Would he want to go back in at this stage? Did he ever waver in his mindset, Harry?
I have no idea whether Colin would want to play now or not. That's really a personal decision for him to make. His status now, historically, as the most significant athlete of his era. It's the most significant athlete. It's not Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods or some of the other superstar performers out there. Mm. It's Colin Kaepernick, because of the statement that he made, the sacrifices that he made, and the fact that he was not only right, he was prophetic and prescient in terms of calling attention to this issue. So in some way, perhaps, there was a chance that America could avoid exactly what we're going through now, which is tearing the nation apart. And so whether he plays or not, I mean, if it were me and he asked me, Doc, what do you think I ought to do? I would tell him straight up, Cap, why go back out there and take them hits? Why go back out there where you have a 129% chance of suffering some injury that's going to force you to miss a practice or to miss a game? Why not go to school, get yourself a PhD, come out and run for governor? You know, get into a position where you can make the changes that you advocated. It's one thing to take a knee and demonstrate a need. It's another thing to follow through and begin to systematically, strategically dismantle the kinds of structures and so forth that made it necessary for you to take that protest, make that protest gesture. I mean, that would be my advice to him, but that would be a decision that he would make. He's a very bright, very committed young man, and he also has a lot of raw dog in him. I mean, he might be just the kind of guy to stand up and say, and I'm going to tell you what else. I'm going back out here and play, and I'm going to lead my team to the Super Bowl. But I guarantee you this, if he did go on the team, those players on that team would play for him at a level that not even the people who drafted them, who the owner that pays their salary, knew that they had the capability of doing, because they believe in him just that much. So at this point, it's really a personal decision. But if it were me, you know, football at the NFL level is about as close as you can get to war and still stay civil. And for him to go back out there and take those hits, I would advise him against it, but that would be his decision, and it could go either way. And whatever way he decided to go would be absolutely correct.
Yeah. I mentioned you were part of the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the 1968 Black Power Salute. You said there, Colin Kaepernick, the most significant athlete of his generation. Excuse my ignorance here, but the protests I'm seeing on television right across American cities, people are taking a knee. That is one of the prominent gestures that we are seeing. That is directly Kaepernick's influence, is it? Or does taking a knee predate Kaepernick?
Not really. Kaepernick was the one that put his face on it. Kaepernick was the one that made it a protest gesture. Like, there were people all over America who were raising a fist from 1966 to 1968 within the context of the Black Power movement. But it was Smith and Carlos who raised the fist on the podium at the Mexico City Olympics and created the most iconic sports image of the 20th century. You can go anywhere in the world. You can go to the jungles of Brazil or the Amazon Basin and raise a fist and say Mexico City, and somebody say, yeah. You know, they know that gesture. In the same sense, it was Colin Kaepernick that made taking a knee profound protest gesture. There are pictures of protesters on the Selma march taking a knee on the bridge, on the Pettus Bridge. There are pictures of Dr. King taking a knee in prayer. But what Colin Kaepernick did was to make it a profound protest gesture, and it literally, when in this business, in the sports business and entertainment business, when they don't have to say two names to identify you, when they can simply say Oprah, or when they can simply say Magic, or when they can simply say Kobe, you've made it. But there's another level at which your name becomes a verb, so it's not just Kaepernick, it's Kaepernickin. So you turn on the TV and there are 1,000 people outside of the embassy in Berlin who are taking a knee. They're Kaepernickin that protest. So Cap has become a verb, and that's another level. You haven't heard about it said Oprah-ing or Kobe-ing or anything, but people are Kaepernickin their protest. Cops are taking a knee. Legislators are taking a knee. Federal judges are taking a knee. Pastors and preachers are taking a knee, and it's because not of Dr. King who took a knee on the Pettus, John Lewis who took a knee on the Pettus Bridge. It's because of Colin Kaepernick.
Yes. I know he sat on the bench initially and then decided to take a knee. Did you help him pick that gesture? Did he come up with that on his own?
No. You know, one of the things that I've always tried to avoid is diminishing or in any way overshadowing the efforts and sacrifices of these athletes who've taken these stands.
Sure.
I did not choose what Smith and Carlos did. I did not influence what Kaepernick chose to do. This is his gesture. Mm. It's his sacrifice. It's his vision and inventiveness. And while he started off sitting on a cooler, after talking to a soldier who said, "I understand what you're doing. I understand what you're trying to say. I understand what it is you're protesting. But why give those who would demean and diminish and put out a fake interpretation of what you're doing the option to say he's not standing for the anthem and in respect of the flag? Why not take a knee?" Mm. Because that's as close to you as you can get to prayer and still be legitimate. Mm. And on top of it, you have players who take a knee after every game and most of them before a game in the locker room in prayer. So at the end of the day, Cap was doing something that athletes have been doing for generations, taking a knee in the locker room in prayer before a game. Some of them very publicly from both teams in the NFL, in the middle of the field, taking a knee in front of thousands of people, and there's not been any comment about it. There hasn't been any denunciation of it. But if Colin Kaepernick takes a knee in protest of 147 black men, women, and children being murdered with virtual impunity in every case in the United States, all of a sudden, this is a huge problem. This is terrible. This is awful. How can he do that? How can he be that disrespectful? It's nonsense. But then we have to realize there's never been a protest movement in American society where mainstream white America has stood up and said, "Amen, that's justified." Not one. They've attacked every protest movement going back to abolition. And so it takes time. It takes struggle. It takes commitment. You have to move from protest gesture to strategic action. And that is where we're headed again in this instance.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Harry Edwards. Dr. Edwards, I saw you said before of Kaepernick that we have reached the fourth wave of athlete activism in Kaepernick. What are the hallmarks of this generation and their activism?
Well, I think that the one thing that has changed everything from the third wave, which was Smith and Carlos and Arthur Ashe and Bill Russell and Jim Brown and Kurt Flood and the Wilma Rudolph and that group, is the social media. In 1968, when I was organizing the Olympic Project for Human Rights, I would get on a rotary phone and dial 50 people, hope that 20 of them would call me back, hope that at least 10 of them wouldn't think that I was totally insane, and maybe two of them would say, "Amen, what can I do to help?" And so today you have athletes who can make their statement and then simply go on their laptop or go on their mobile phone and hit the single most powerful four-letter word in the history of the English language, S-E-N-D. And automatically, it will go out to everybody who follows them, and from them, it will go out to millions more. And the next thing you know, within a period of less than 10 minutes, you have 4, 5, 6, or 7 million people who are tuned in to this message, and many of them tweeting back, Instagramming back, Twittering back, and in cases where they're able to contact a person directly, emailing back saying amen. So that's the main difference. But there's also the fact that this generation thanks to what happened in the past, thanks to books like The Revolt of the Black Athlete, is more conscious of the mandate and mission of athlete activism going all the way back to Major Taylor, who in 1896 was protesting not being accepted as a world-class cyclist and banned from cycling events. 1896, the same year that Plessy versus Ferguson was edict came out of the United States Supreme Court mandating segregation by race. And it wasn't about separate but equal. Those words don't appear anywhere in the edict. Plessy versus Ferguson was a Supreme Court judgment whose purpose was to push black people in this country as back as close to slavery, the subsistence, subservience, and subjugation of slavery as possible without calling it that. And so from the very outset, with America's first black superstar, the cyclist, Major Taylor, there was a role in the struggle to undermine that, to resist that among athletes, among black sports participants. And so today, thanks to the revolt of the black athletes, thanks to the social media, thanks to their ability to communicate with each other, this generation, this fourth wave of athlete activists is the most informed, astute group to come along thus far.
Okay. I have two last quick questions and then I will let you go because you've been more than good with your time. On Donald Trump, I think in the main people would agree with your general assessment of his presidency and how he conducts himself. In the context of the overall picture you're talking about, he is, relatively speaking, a blink of an eye, you know, 4 years, hopefully, potentially eight. Is that, do you see Trump as insignificant-ish in so much as you can an American president, and given that the Black Lives Movement started with an African-American in the White House and, you know, Trump will be gone and all that nonsense and all that heat will disappear? Or does his presidency, can it do lasting damage?
His, the Trump presidency will take a generation at least for us to get past. You cannot be the most powerful man in the world in charge of 3,000 nukes, a superpower-level economy, the most powerful military in the world, and have all of that political authority at home and not leave a heck of a footprint. Mm. And in this instance, a knee on the neck of the American people. And so we're going to be a generation simply trying to fumigate the White House and clean up the mess that he has left behind. As far as Black Lives Matter movement emerging under Barack Obama, we understood that there were things that Barack couldn't do in the White House, even that some white presidents would have been able to do if they had been inclined to do so. But as the first black president, he had to always keep in the forefront before the American people that he was president of all of the people. Mm. He stood up and made a statement when Trayvon Martin was murdered. He said, that could have been my son. Mm. This is not right. He stood up and made a statement when a Harvard University professor was arrested, entering his home by police. He stood up and made a statement that that wasn't right. He stood up and made a statement when some other atrocities took place. But he had to always have in the forefront that he was president of all of the people. That left a tremendous space for community-level groups, for activist groups, to make statements not against Barack or in protest of his administration, but in assistance to his administration. So these three black women, in the wake of Trayvon Martin's murderer being freed, created this hashtag, Black Lives Matter, which morphed into a slogan, which ultimately evolved into a movement. Mm. This happened under the administration of Barack Obama. The civil rights movement came to its greatest resurgence under LBJ, and he had a poverty movement. He had a movement to help clean up some of the inequities in American society. It was LBJ who gave a speech saying, "We shall overcome." But that didn't mean that black people and activists and others could just sit down. We couldn't sit down on LBJ. We couldn't sit down on Barack Obama. And it is most certainly the case that we cannot and will not sit down on the watch of this pathological liar and morally malignant degenerate who occupies the Oval Office now.
Okay. Last question and then final word to you. Where does it all go from here, in short? I mean, you talk about lots of things there, even in a sporting context, the increased awareness that athletes have now and the advances in technology and how maybe that can expedite some kind of progress. Equally, you talk about the damage that Trump is doing, and that is not to mention the cycles of poverty and institutional racism and all the things you've talked about embedded in the fabric of the country. What is a realistic hope maybe for the first half of the 21st century, Harry?
You know, I've been asked all the time, what was the greatest slogan coming out of the 1960s? Was it "We shall overcome"? Black power, power to the people, freedom now. What was the greatest slogan coming out of the 1960s? Was "Keep the faith." And I say that because I realized something early on. When a reporter asked me, why was I doing this? Wasn't Jackie Robinson enough? Why was I organizing the Olympic Project of Human Rights? The reality is that our circumstances in this country, as Americans, are dynamic and continual. Our struggle, therefore, has to be multifaceted and as diverse as the challenges we face, and there are no final victories. The Constitution puts the mandate for change on we the people. This is why we've had all of these movements. It's part of the DNA, as I stated, of American politics. This struggle will go on. There are no final victories. And so it is not an issue of when does it end. We are in a struggle to create that more perfect union. We're never going to get to a perfect union.
Sure.
That is part of America as well. And so there'll be no final victories. We're going to continue the struggle after this. We're going to have to clean up the mess left behind by the guy who's sitting up there faking it as the president now. We're going to have to come bring about change, but more than just change, it's going to have to be progress. We're going to have to realize that there's the difference. Progress is one of those concepts that's a lot like profit. At some point, it comes down to who's keeping the books. We're going to have to realize that not every change is progress. We're going to have to struggle toward progress. And so there are no final victories. We cannot get tired. We cannot be frustrated. We cannot think that anger and outrage will get it done. The difference between a movement and a mob is follow through. It's disciplined, it's strategic discipline. And when we really begin to wrap our minds around that history, we not only keep the faith, we become optimistic. I'm very optimistic. We've been through worse. We went through a civil war, but we came out better. We went through a bloody labor movement, but we came out better. We went through a civil rights movement that killed three times as many people as were killed in the 9/11 terrorist attack. But we came out better. And so I have tremendous faith in that streak of decency and commitment and stick-to-itiveness of the American people. We're going to be just fine.
Dr. Harry Edwards, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you very much.
The OTB Podcast Network.